hunger in Kenya. It's just, oh, there's no maize. We have a shortage of maize. But is maize the only food that we can actually consume in Kenya?
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to this episode of the Elephant Podcast, where we basically discuss issues that help us reimagine state and society. And today we are going to delve into matters food. As we know, this is the 1 month where a lot of the critical food conversations are had globally, nationally, and even within our respective organizations. October 7th is the World Food Safety Day. This is also the month where the UN Food Systems Summit is held. It's also the 1 month for which we have the World Food Day. And in having this conversation, there are certain things we have to keep in mind. Some of them including the fact that anywhere between 640 million and about 768 million people globally go to bed hungry daily. About 3 billion people cannot afford a healthy diet. About 2 billion people are either overweight or obese. And yet about 462 million people are underweight. And to add to this, nearly a third of all the food that is produced globally is either lost or wasted. And these are critical and staggering statistics. But beyond the numbers, beyond the data, these are lives that we are dealing with. And to be able to unpack this conversation, today we are joined by an eminent scholar who is an expert in these matters and whose bread and butter is helping us and the wider society unpack these issues. Karibu sana, introduce yourself.
Thank you so much, Darius, for having me. My name is Claire Nasikia Kello. I work as a food campaigner at Greenpeace Africa.
And just to start out, what is your assessment of the state of food security and food systems, even as we work towards celebrating the World Food Day?
In regards to your question, thank you so much for it. I think it is a dire situation when it comes to issues of food security and nutrition across the world, but particularly in Africa and Kenya. Just recently, we saw about 2.1 million Kenyans are facing hunger. And this is not just this year. We've had these numbers of Kenyans facing hunger. For instance, between about 2014 and 2020, we had about 92 million Kenyans who are at risk of starvation because, you know, there's drought, lack of food, lack of water. And aside from hunger, there's the issue of the available food being of poor quality or not safe for consumption. So whereas the food is there, the people cannot consume it. And for we to say that as a country or as a region, we are food secure, we have to make sure that food exists to people at all times in different physical and economical situations whereby these people can be able to access this food at certain times. If they cannot buy it, they can get it from their farms, they can get it from their social gatherings. Then we can say we are food secure. But at the moment, I think it's a dire situation. We are seeing such high numbers of people that are under malnourished. We are seeing cases of stunted growth among children. We're seeing cases of children who are obese because of consuming food that is not of the required nutrients as per their dietary needs.
Okay. I mean, that's interesting. We're considering all these players and facets in the wider what we'd even call the food ecosystem, which is the policy and regulatory gaps that exist in our access to food.
You know, policy plays a critical role when it comes to food availability, or rather access to food by the local mwananchi. For instance, in Kenya, the policies that we have around agriculture have created a barrier. They're actually making sure that more Kenyans are starving instead of reducing the number of Kenyans that are starving. So I'll just lightly touch on one or two of them. For instance, we have the agricultural transformation sector strategy. This is supposed to guide agricultural activities between 2019 all the way to 2029, I believe, 10 years. But when you look at this strategy, the way it is set, it is one of those strategies that, you know, tells us that we have to get farmers out of farming into more lucrative jobs. We have to get Kenyans consuming more processed foods. And this is a problem. And I say it is a problem because 80% of the food that we consume in Kenya is produced by smallholder farmers. So when we shift these farmers out of farming, how are we going to curb food insecurity that is currently in existence in Kenya? So we want farmers to abandon their land. Once they've abandoned their land, some large multinational corporation comes and they have access to this land and they're growing food. And this farmer is somewhere in Nairobi working as a night guard or a house girl, someone who was able to produce food before for their own consumption and the consumption of others. And then looking at also more processed foods, this just calls in obesity and other non-communicable diseases, because more processed foods have high amounts of sugar, high amounts of salt, and we're looking at diseases like diabetes and many others. And that's a problem. So we are not addressing, the policies that we have in place are not helping us address food insecurity in the country, but rather it's just creating more barriers. And these barriers are a way of benefiting a few chosen individuals or players within the food space.
Okay. First of all, why are you throwing shade at Lunges?
No. I'm a Lunge, so I cannot even try and throw shade at them. They are my people.
Anyway, I know we came to Nairobi to catch a shamba, but so, I mean, just looking at the third issue in this, which is seeing the fact that Kenya imports a lot of food. We import eggs, we import strawberries, we import even maize. We import a lot of the onions, you know, you name it. We have such a huge dependency on our import infrastructure to feed our population. And looking at it, what are some of the risks does this pose to, you know, food access, food availability, food affordability within the country? What are some of the key risks we have to deal with, given the fact that we basically outsourced our food sustenance to basically foreign countries?
First of all, when we depend so much on food importation, we are exposing ourselves to low quality food or food that has been contaminated. It could be with heavy metals, it could be with chemical pesticides, it could be with pathogens, you know, so forth. We've seen cases where sugar in our country contained mercury just a number of years ago. Recently, we were told the maize that, you know, we imported into the country also a few years ago had a high amount of aflatoxins that was, you know, that could have harmed Kenyans. So when we rely so much on imports, the first thing is we expose ourselves to low quality food. The second thing is that we are hurting the farmers who produce food that feeds us. The imports normally come in and they are sold at a cheaper price as opposed to the locally produced goods, because these imports from their country of origin, maybe their cost of inputs is lower, so the cost of production is lower. So when they are shipped to other countries, they are likely to be cheaper than the goods that are produced locally. If you look at the cost of inputs in Kenya, is very high. So the cost of overall food production also is very high, and that is likely to affect the prices of food. So when we're getting these cheap imports into the country, what you're doing is that we are killing the smallholder farmers, because everyone, you won't want to buy coconuts that go for 100 shillings, yet there's imported coconuts that goes for 50 shillings. You want to save a bit of money, you know? So we're killing the smallholder farmers. And like with the COVID pandemic, we saw that when the borders were closed, countries closed their borders, you know, to curb the spread of the COVID-19 pandemic. Farmers in Kenya, and I recall very clearly President Uhuru saying that farmers in Kenya were the ones responsible for feeding the Kenyan population at that time, not agricultural imports. And so if we are killing them with imports, then how are we as a nation becoming resilient to such pandemics or such shocks in the future that are likely to affect our food systems. It means that we are exposing ourselves or we're making ourselves vulnerable to some of these shocks or some of these issues should they arise in the future, because now we are completely dependent on imports. If this country closes their border on us, we're not even able to produce food. We'll start seeing all Kenyans are dying of hunger. We need food aid because this number of Kenyans have no access to food. That's what we will be exposing ourselves to.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, that's interesting. And even to, you know, Claire, I mean, just listening to you about the vulnerability and the risks built into the kind of setup we've put our, well, sector, you know, the food sector and the food ecosystem and the food systems. I'm thinking about the fact that the top four, when you look at, is it called the National Food Basket that is computed every year by the Kenya National Bureau of Statistics? The top four, actually almost the top five, seven, you know, whatever, most consumed foods in Kenya are the type of products that by and large, which, you know, they are mechanized in terms of their production and in the hands of a few industry players, you know, that is maize, wheat, milk, partly bananas and their, you know, resultant products. I mean, what do you make of that?
I would term that corporate capture of the food systems.
Oh.
Because if food production is consolidated or the power is held by a few individuals, then that's the capture. These people are not in it to feed the nation. They're in it to make profits. Mm-hmm. So then they dictate the prices within which we buy the foods because they control the market. It's like a monopoly, you know, they control the market. So if I want to sell the milk to you at 120 shillings, you will have to buy it at 120 shillings because we have managed to eliminate farmers who would otherwise give us competition towards that produce. And you see these people, what they're doing, for instance, the milk, what's happening with milk? We know the key players when it comes to milk. And they're trying to pass laws, you know, trying to twist government bodies or government officials or policies so that farmers are out of their way. So if we have farmers like producing milk, then these farmers are not able to produce milk or they can't sell milk to the consumers directly. Reason being, this key player wants to control the market so that they can be able to get profits. And that for me is corporate capture of just the food systems completely. Because food systems are supposed to be diverse. We're not supposed to consume monocultures alone. Mm-hmm. We need diverse foods for purposes of nourishing our bodies, for purposes of getting the necessary nutrients. I just cannot consume milk and maize alone. I need milk, maize, sorghum, beans, all sorts of food for my body to be properly nourished and have the relevant nutrients. But if we're just consuming monocultures alone, then it also boils down to the issue of health. Aside from the corporate capture of the food systems, but then we have also the issues of health. How many people are malnutritioned? How many children have stunted growth? How many of them cannot go to school because of, you know, they are undernutritioned? It's so many issues. So it's not just a matter of them, a few individuals or a few companies controlling the food, but it has a ripple effect on the health. It has a ripple effect on the education systems. It's a wholesome system, not just, it doesn't exist alone.
Okay. So, I mean, I'm thinking just as a follow-up on that, I mean, we are dealing with the fact that we are a country with very high levels of counterfeit products in the market. And of course, this predominantly and disproportionately affects the foods and the drugs, medicines that we import. How do we make sense of this issue of, as you had mentioned before, substandard goods or outrightly counterfeited goods?
So the problem we have in Kenya, Darius, is that we have government authorities, government agencies that do not do their work.
Okay.
In terms of counterfeit products, we have the Anti-Counterfeit Authority, and this is an authority that was formed through Parliament. I think there's the Counterfeit Authority, the Counterfeit Act of 2008, if I'm not wrong. It led to the formation of the Anti-Counterfeit Authority, which is supposed to curb the sale, the production of, you know, counterfeit products in Kenya. Because when you look at the Kenyan market, we have so many counterfeit products. What is the role of this authority? Because if you're mandated, if you're the government agency that is mandated in doing a certain piece of work, and that work is not done, then essentially you're failing.
Mm-hmm.
So we have the policies, we have the bodies that are supposed to be doing this work, but they've just, for the lack of a diplomatic word, wameka too. In so how someone else would put it, like they're just there, you know. You get a salary at the end of the day, you go home, you come the following morning, you hang your coat on the chair, you know, and you get the salary, and you don't really care, you don't do much. Like, I'll take you back a couple of weeks ago, I think CABS, the National Standards Body, also put out a notice saying some of the flowers that were sold in the supermarket shelves had, you know, a high amount of aflatoxins.
Mm-hmm.
And they were supposed to be gotten rid of, you know, from the shelves until they were rectified or the aflatoxin levels were reduced. But there's some supermarkets still stock those flowers.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So you wonder, okay, you've issued this notice. You're saying, okay, this flower should be gotten off the shelves. But then when you go, you find them on the shelves. Then what is your work? So you've issued the notice, but there's no proper follow-up. So when Kenyans go, they just buy the same flour. You know, they're already consuming food that is toxic to them. But yes, we have a body that's supposed to be doing that work, protecting Kenyans from consuming counterfeit products or consuming substandard goods.
Interesting. Thinking about it, just switching gears a bit, I'm thinking about the fact that one of the things that has happened in the last 2 years, and I know it has affected pretty much every facet of human existence, and that is the fact that we've been the issue about the decline in hospital visits, and especially related to, you know, hygiene-related issues, rather. And the whole bunch of conversation, people say, you know, it's because people are no longer eating out, because a lot of people are working from home, there's change in food handling. I mean, you as a person who's been in that space, what has been, how do you make sense of this? Is it just proper food handling by, you know, homes, retail, hotels, caterers, transporters? Is this a new norm we've created for ourselves that is working? Where are we?
I would think it's about proper food handling practices. After COVID, you know, not really after COVID, but during the advent of COVID, you know, we were washing hands. You couldn't get somewhere without having sanitized your hands and all that. And I think that contributed to a reduction in the number of diseases that arise as a result of consuming contaminated food. Could be by pathogens, you know, bacteria, viruses, and all that. If you look at the, probably, let's say, the informal sector, the food handling practices, they are not as hygienic as they ought to be. But now COVID came, you had to wash your hands. The number of food outlets that were open were also few, because remember, people had lost their jobs. So if you have to go and consume food somewhere, you have to wash your hands, you have to do stuff, most of which people never used to do before. And this one, I'll speak very... I'll be biased a little bit. Allow me to be biased a little bit. I have visited some areas whereby, you know, washing hands is not a necessity. You buy a fruit on the road and then you just eat.
Mm-hmm.
But now with COVID, everyone was worried. You're being told, don't touch your nose, don't touch your mouth. So you have to, you're forced to literally sanitize your hands. You're literally forced to wash your hands before you can even consume food. So I would relate it to the reduction in the number of hospital visits.
I mean, that's interesting. Moving just for conversation forward. Again, this is another statistic that's widely quoted across different sources, but need a bit more nuance, which is the fact that nearly a third of all food that is produced is lost or wasted. At what levels are this food wasted? And what are some of the ways we can begin to, you know, mitigate this food loss and food wastage, considering we already have almost 600-700 million, which is almost 10% of the global population, who go to bed hungry?
You know, when it comes to food wastage, majority of the food wastage, you'll find that happens within where that food is produced, either because of the lack of proper storage facilities, lack of infrastructure, you know, where food can actually move from one region to another where it's required. And aside from that, when you now move to the global food systems, how food moves from one region to another, there's also a lot of food wastage in that. Because, for instance, Kenya does, let's say, for example, Kenya doesn't produce apples, but mm-hmm. another country like Brazil or South Africa produces apples, and those apples are needed in Kenya. So they have to be shipped all the way or transported all the way to from Brazil to Kenya, from South Africa to Kenya. And in the process, some of this food goes bad. So when it's reaching the country that it's intended to, half of that food cannot be consumed because either it's gone bad or it was not preserved properly or just something happened to it. It's not in a good condition to be consumed. That's one. The other thing when it comes now to the global food systems and in regards to food waste, mm-hmm. you find that we as consumers, you know, we have embraced this culture of food consumerism so much that we want food that is in a perfect shape. You know, when you go to the market and you find some tomato that looks ovalish, you don't want it. Mm-hmm. You want a tomato that, you know, looks perfect, doesn't have any spots at all. Mm-hmm. So if you moved food from this country to this other country that was not properly, no, didn't look properly, or it's not appealing to the eyes as to how it's supposed to look, you know, what we see in the movies or in the videos or in the TVs or whatever, of perfect looking food, and that food doesn't look that way, consumers will not want to buy it. So that food mm-hmm. will be thrown away. Remember, it has traveled for miles to just get to this country, and then it's thrown away. So there's a lot of food wastage. And one of the ways in which we can all curb that food wastage is, of course, we need to encourage local consumption of foods. So foods that are locally relevant, locally available, instead of carrying out massive importation of food, and then those food imports get here and they are not needed, or they compete with the local, foods that are available. And so you find that either the local foods are wasted, people don't want it because could be because of higher prices that I had mentioned initially, or just that, you know, it doesn't taste the same as the imported food, which then mm-hmm. leads to wastage of that food or loss of that food. And then also the lack of those storage facilities. So if we have storage facilities, let's say the farmers in Muranga mm-hmm. who produce potatoes, or the farmers somewhere else who produce potatoes as well or tomatoes, they have access to proper storage facilities, or the farmers in Trans Nzoia have access to proper drying facilities, so that when they harvest the maize, this maize is not contaminated with aflatoxins because, you know, it did not dry properly. So that reduces food wastage. That's storage facilities. And then infrastructure. Is the food able to move quickly from one region to another where it's needed? If that food is not able to move quickly to the other regions that is needed, then it's going to go to waste, because one, if we don't have the storage facilities and there's no proper infrastructure to ensure that this food gets to the relevant markets or the relevant areas on time, then it's going to be wasted, or it's going to be lost.
Oh, wow. Now I'm thinking, you have maize in Kitale that is, being contaminated with, you call it aflatoxin.
Aflatoxins.
Yeah, and then now you have your 2.1 million Kenyans who are basically starving in like 12 counties. And that's not even all. I mean, we know about basically a third of the Kenyan populations below the poverty line, and that number could even be higher, you know. I mean, how do we disaggregate this failure? I mean, it's become like a perennial thing. It's almost like taxes and everything else we do. You know, every year we have to declare a certain set number of Kenyans starving, despite devolution, despite, you know, devolved agricultural ministry, despite a growing national budget. Or we can no longer keep talking about Kenyans are facing starvation and, you know, we need intervention by our global partners or diplomatic communities or the relief foundations.
The issue of Kenyans dying from hunger is a matter of our leadership having their priorities. I don't want to say bottom up. having their priorities, I think, topsy-turvy, whereby we are prioritizing that which is not important and leaving out that which is important. And hunger in Kenya is a subject of three things. Uh-huh. Budgetary allocation, policy, uh-huh. and infrastructure.
Okay.
I say budgetary allocation because when you look at the amount of money that is allocated towards the big four agenda, where we have food, food and nutrition security or something. You look at that amount of money. I think this in the 2021-2022 budget is about 60 billion. And that money is supposed to go towards, you know, building boreholes, you know, irrigation schemes, making sure that farmers have the required inputs. But when it comes to accounting, how much of that money actually does that?
Mm-hmm.
There's no proof to show that, you know, this 60 billion went through this, or this 40 billion went to do this and this and this. And this is the number of farmers whom that amount of money has helped. And this is how those farmers are actually helping address food insecurity or hunger in Kenya. Or we have this irrigation scheme that has, you know, it's producing this amount of bags of grains, could be sorghum, could be millet or maize. And this millet is being used to feed the starving communities in Turkana, in Marsabit.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing of that sort. If any case, we're seeing these irrigation schemes failing. We saw that Galana Kulalu, like 5.9 billion Kenya shillings was just sunk and nothing mm-hmm. happened. And we have our president here talking about, you know, we are taking every measure to make sure that no Kenyan dies of hunger. Kenyans have been dying of hunger. We know we are at the mercy of NGOs that donate food aid to us. And mm-hmm. in the process, we have, you know, our dignity stripped. You're getting Kenyans walking for kilometers to just go and get yellow maize, which is not even supposed to be for human consumption. You're getting Kenyans to queue to go and get, you know, just a cup of beans. Yet right. we have a budget that is supposed to be addressing such kind of situation to make sure that, you know, it doesn't get to a place whereby Kenyans have actually to go and queue for them to get food. When we have the president telling us that, you know, this is my top 4 agenda, that no Kenyan will die of hunger, you know, your dignity will be protected, or you won't be exposed to the indignities that come with hunger. And when we move to policy, all the policies that we have are just, you know, gearing towards or pushing Kenyans towards food insecurity. For instance, the Seed and the Plant Varieties Act, it says farmers cannot share seeds among themselves and they cannot sell seeds that are not certified. And these seeds that are not certified ideally are indigenous seeds. And these indigenous seeds are the seeds that, you know, are hardier, you know, when it comes to being acclimatized to the local climatic conditions of a certain area. So if farmers have access to these indigenous seeds, it means that mm-hmm. they can be able to produce food easily, as opposed to the hybrid seeds where they have to buy, that requires a lot of water to, you know, to just grow probably one crop like maize. But if they have access to these indigenous seeds, they can actually grow food at any given time. And then these seeds are accustomed to our weather patterns. So they won't have to worry much about water. Even if the rains are little, they are guaranteed of getting something, as opposed to when they use these hybrid seeds. But now when you have laws that actually criminalize them from using the seeds, and you're thinking that, you know, we have to achieve food security, how are we going to achieve it when we are actually stopping these farmers from producing food that is required by Kenyans?
Mm-hmm.
And then infrastructure right now, we have, before I even go to infrastructure, we have also counties, you know, the county boundaries and movement of food within the counties. Whereas the constitution allows, you know, the counties to impose taxes and revenue collection. But the way in which it's being done, if someone is transporting food from one county to another, you have to pay levies, you have to pay taxes for you to be able to take food to that county. Then this is also, you know, discouraging people to move their food. So I'd rather sell if I'm producing millet or maize or sweet potatoes in Budalangi, I would rather just leave them in Budalangi instead of taking them to Turkana, whereby if I pass by all these counties, I have to pay levies. So imagine how many counties will I have moved by the time I get to Turkana? How much money will I have paid? And there's also the cost of fuel. Remember, some of the roads are not so good. If it's the rainy season, you're likely to spend a number of days on the road. So you're looking at money at that. So you're thinking, will I pay all this amount of money to just get my food to Marsabit? Or should I just sell it here at a throwaway price? But at least, you know, I'll have gotten some bit of money.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we have so many issues that are curtailing or stopping Kenyans from achieving food security. And most of this are leadership issues or leadership problems, and they can be solved by our leaders if they wanted to. They have no political goodwill to do that. I think for them, Kenyans dying of hunger is a situation whereby they can build their political mileage and say, I donated this, I did this, or you saw we brought this 2 billion, like I saw the Treasury the other day after the president announced that hunger was a national disaster. Now, hunger and drought was a national disaster. The Ministry of Treasury, you know, released 2 billion, and the then cabinet minister of devolution said now that 2 billion would go towards restoring old boreholes and wells. They're thinking of restoring old boreholes and wells when people have already died. Communities have lost their livestock. Why can't they do it before? It's not an emergency situation. We have the Met Department that keeps telling us, oh, we're going to have drought.
Yeah.
This season, the rainfall will be minimal. Doesn't the government take into consideration those measures? Because if you're coming to restore boreholes when people have already died, people have lost their livestock, so what's the need?
Exactly. So, I mean, just thinking, I mean, you in your space had Greenpeace and you know, the other experts within the, you know, the food and agricultural space, you know, by extension. What's your crystal ball of the future? I mean, looking at the current trends, our capacity to provide for ourselves or not, the current population growth, the impact of the current recent policies we've had, our budgetary allocations towards agriculture. What is sort of your crystal ball into the short and medium term?
For us at Greenpeace, we believe the solution lies in agroecology. And this is whereby smallholder farmers are actually empowered to produce more. Smallholder farmers are in charge of the food systems, not multinational corporations. I say smallholder farmers in charge of the food systems in that we are able to consume food that is locally relevant, food that is locally available. We are not depending on other nations for our food needs. Remember, if we have to, I remember a quote, I think it's by Thomas Sankara, or if I'm not wrong, he who feeds you controls you. So if we're depending on other nations to give us food, or other nations, you know, to import their food, or we're depending on multinational corporations, or, you know, this big agricultural players to grow the food for us. What happens in the event that they do not want to grow food? They want to start, you know, probably keeping cattle on their farm for other things, or they want to start keeping horses. What then happens to us? That's why it's important that we empower smallholder farmers to produce more food, and we empower them through policy support, through budgetary allocation. So we need to see policies that actually say this amount of money is going towards smallholder farmers, and it indeed goes towards smallholder farmers. We want to see policies that say, okay, smallholder farmers can, you know, use their seeds, they can sell, they can share, they can exchange the seeds. Because when you do that, first of all, these seeds, they don't even need to buy them. So you're reducing the cost of inputs. So if you're reducing the cost of inputs, food is likely to be cheaper. Consumers will actually access food. People will be able to buy food. So even if you have 100 shillings, you can be guaranteed that you can get, you know, ugali and skuma wiki for the night or for the day. So several of these factors are why we as Greenpeace Africa are advocating for agroecology. We want to see biodiversity thriving, not just on our farms, but on our plates. We don't want to see Kenyans just consuming maize alone. Whenever there is hunger in Kenya, it's just, oh, there's no maize. We have a shortage of maize. But is maize the only food that we can actually consume in Kenya? We have so many other varieties of foods. So when they're saying, okay, there's no maize, but what is the alternative? Don't we have sweet potatoes? Aren't they a source of carbohydrates? Don't we have cassava? Don't we have yams? Don't we have millet and sorghum, etc., that Kenyans can actually consume? So it's a matter of, you know, having different diverse foods that are produced by smallholder farmers who understand the needs of Kenyans, the needs of our country, because they've been feeding us since time immemorial, and they still do on their small pieces of land. It's just a matter of making sure that they have access to land, policy supports them, and they have budgetary allocation.
Okay, and I will not let you go before I ask the issue of the fact that there's a lot of trees cut down, especially around Nairobi, to pave way for tarmac and Cabro and all these so-called infrastructure development. What do we do?
We have one problem. We have one solution, and that solution is just to plant more trees.
Mm-hmm.
Kenyans, I, you know, Wangari Maathai fought for some of this green spaces that the government is just, you know, cutting down. And mm-hmm. I don't know if Kenyans are detached from the environment or we do not understand the role of trees in our lives, because people will see a tree being cut down, we'll talk about it on Twitter for a day and we'll move on. Like, there's no civil action. Are we as Kenyans coming together to protest and say no to this massive cutting down of trees? Are we as environmentalists coming down to oppose this massive cutting down of trees? No. We'll talk about it for a couple of days and then we'll move on. We'll take pictures and then we'll move on. I think our government doesn't care about our environment. It's so clear. It doesn't care about the environment. There are reports that show that, you know, the urban heat island in Nairobi is increasing and this is attributed to the loss of trees. I think it's time for we Kenyans or Nairobians to hold our governments accountable. So if it means civil action, people are out there demonstrating, you know.
Okay. Nairobians, you've heard, you need to go out there and tell your government through civic action, through legal frameworks, whatever the constitution or the other respective policies provide, to challenge the fact that you're losing trees in this country, in a country where already the national forest cover or tree cover is barely 10%, you know, on average. Thank you very much, Claire Naseki, on that. Thank you very much. It's always a pleasure to explore this kind of conversations. And I know we'll still have one more conversation, which would be about the UN Food Summit coming up next week. But that is all for now. Thank you once again, Claire.
Thank you so much for having me, Darius.